Sankara and Ramana by Dr. T.M.P. Mahadevan. He's the head of the philosophy department, University of Madras.
Okay. Mm. Tell me what Ramana?
Sankara.
Shankara.
Well, he gave a lecture in front of Bhagavan at the request of everybody in the hall. Because he went to the U.S. and he gave... You know, he'd travel around and giving lectures at universities. And they asked him, well, what did you say? He said, well, I spoke about Atman and Brahman. Mm-hmm. And they're all very curious to hear how he gave a lecture in the U.S. Mm-hmm. He said, can you give one here? And he looked at Bhagavan. He went, Bhagavan said, okay, go ahead, give it.
Wow, oh my goodness,
nose-wracking. And T.M.P. Mahadevan. That there is no difference whatsoever between the teachings of Bhagavad-pada Shankara and those of Bhagavan Ramana will be evident to anyone who has any acquaintance with the writings of these two great masters. Even he started a Shankara mat or hall. He opened a Shankara hall in Chennai. I've been there. And they used to have regular meetings there. You know what I mean? He had like an institution in Madras.
Mm-hmm. Like the Brahmo Samaj or something?
No, Shankara Hall.
Okay.
Adi Shankara. Advaita experience is that is what they teach, and not any system of philosophy or school of thought. It is only when Advaita is wrongly assumed to be a system among systems of philosophy that it would appear that Ramana's teaching or teachings could not be contained within Advaita. Sri B.V. Narasimha Swami makes the following remarks in chapter 13 of his biography of Bhagavan Self-Realization. When the intellect gives place to intuition, there is no difference in the ultimate realization, be it that of an Advaitin, Dvaitin, or Vaisishta Dvaitin, or Shaivite, or Shakta. The works dealt with by him, that is, Bhagavan Ramana, by way of translation into Tamil or adaptation, are, however, of the Advaitic school. Unquote. The assumption here seems to be that Advaita is a school coordinate with Dvaita, etc. But then, why did Bhagavan select Advaita work for translation into Tamil? The reason, obviously, is that Advaita, according to him, does not stand for any limited or partial perspective, but for the plenary truth which includes and transcends all the pluralistic and quasi-pluralistic formulations of it. When Sri Kapali Sastri seeks to distinguish Ramana's teaching from Shankara's in his commentary on Sat Darshanam, the 40 verses on reality, he does so because of the wrong assumption already referred to. The same is the case with the statement made by who? He's going after everyone here. You know, Lakshman Sharma.
Yeah.
And the Tamil commentary of Uladu Narapadu, saying the 40 verses, that the teaching contained in the Uladu Narapadu is meant only for the followers of Advaita. In order to understand the teachings of Ramana and Shankara, it is very essential to remember that Advaita is not a sectarian doctrine. Advaita is a culmination of all religious sects and philosophical schools. It is the common end of all philosophical endeavor and all religious practice. The pluralistic systems are opposed to one another, and they labor under the misconception that Advaita is opposed to them.
Pluralistic system?
Pluralistic. No, the other system. But Advaita has no quarrel with the schools of pluralism, for the principle underlining it is non-quarrel. The Mandukya Karika, Gaudapada, in his Mandukya Karika, Gaudapada, the guru of Shankara, observes that the dualists who obstinately cling to their respective views contradict one another, whereas the Advaitin has no conflict with any of them. You know, the editor writes a note about the author here. In this article, the distinguished author, one of the leading philosophical exponents of the philosophy of Advaita in the world today, is speaking from the doctrinal viewpoint. When it comes to methodology, however, there is a vast difference between Shankara and Sri Ramana. The method taught by the former are largely based on the Mahavakya as being strictly orthodox, while that enjoined by Sri Ramana is open not only to non-Brahmins, but even to non-Hindus. We continue the article. As non-duality is the supreme truth, duality is to be regarded as a variant thereof. The dualists see duality both in the absolute and in the relative phenomena. But non-duality is not in conflict with the dualistic position. Commentary on Gaudapada's teaching, Shankara says that there is no conflict between Advaita and Dvaita, even as there could be no strife between one's organism and the whole as a whole and its parts. Advaita, in short, stands for the highest truth, which is free from all disputations. What is true of the philosophical systems vis-a-vis Advaita is true also of the religious cults. To quote Swami Vivekananda, a peculiarity of Advaita is that from its very start it is non-destructive. This is another glory, the boldness to preach. Do not disturb the faith of any, even if those who thought ignorance have attached themselves to lower forms of worship. That is what it says. Do not disturb, but help everyone to get higher and higher. This idea is not clearly found in any religious system. They are all parts equally striving to attain the whole. The existence of the part is only for this. So from the very first, Advaita had no antagonism with the various sects existing in India. Unquote. It is just interesting to note in this connection that the traditions relating to Shankara's life are unanimous in saying that the great Acharya established on secure foundation the six major faiths constituting Hinduism. In a work called Jiva Mukta Ananda Lahari, Shankara declares that the one who has realized the truth of non-duality gets along with the followers of the different faiths with perfect equanimity, impartiality, and understanding. The critic may ask, does not Shankara criticize in his extensive writings the doctrines of the pluralistic schools and the dogmas of religious cults? The answer is simple. When Shankara points out the defects and inconsistencies in the various schools and cults, he does so not in the spirit of partisan, but with the view to make them whole. As we have pointed out already, partisanship is incompatible with Advaita. The remark that Advaitin has no position of his own is quite pertinent. He is not interested in building up a system of thought. His main interest is in pointing the direction by following which one will eventually come to realize the plenary truth. The philosophical schools and the faiths, whatever be their composition and character, can be of help if they are made to free themselves as far as possible from their dogmatism and fanaticism. The function of criticism performed by Advaita teachers should be viewed not as a destructive procedure, but as a constructive help. This they are enabled to do because Advaita is not a closed system or a circumscribed set of beliefs. When the term Advaita is translated as non-dualism, it is worthwhile to remember the negative prefix, non, applies only to dual, but also to ism. Advaita is not an ism. In fact, even the expression Advaita is an approximation to the truth, not the truth itself. As an illustration of the popular misconception about Shankara's teachings and Bhagavan Ramana's acceptance of all comprehensive truth, of the all-comprehensive truth of Advaita, we may cite a reported conversation between a questioner and Bhagavan. The questioner asks, "The Supreme Spirit, Brahman, is real. The world, Jagat, is illusion," is the stock phrase of Sri Shankara. Yet others say, "The world is reality," which is true. In his reply, Bhagavan said that both the statements are true, but at different levels of understanding and experience, which is exactly the teaching of Shankara's Advaita. The absolute truth is that the Supreme Spirit is non-dual. As Bhagavan put it, there is only being and self-realization, and nothing but being. But he adds, the term reality is used also in a different sense and applied loosely by some thinkers to objects. It is as a concession to them that degrees of reality are recognized in Advaita. Apparently, reality, pratibhasika satya, belongs to the contents of dreams and illusions. Empirical reality, vyavaharika satya, to the things of the objective world and the waking state. The absolute reality, paramattika satya, is of course the non-dual self. When one has realized the absolute truth, it will be evident there is no sense in talking about degrees of truth or reality. On another occasion, Bhagavan explained to a devotee the three modes of approach to the metaphysical problem of creation as comprehended in Advaita. One, the highest mode is Ajativada, as formulated by Gaudapada. According to this mode, there is no creation, no dissolution, no bondage, no release, no one striving for release. Nothing whatever is born is the truth. And the second is, the mode is Drishti Srishti Vada, according to which creation is simultaneous as in dreams. And three, the last mode is Srishti Drishti Vada, which holds that there is creation in stages or graded creation. The difference between the second and the third mode is explained very clearly by Bhagavan in the Vichara Sangraha, self-inquiry. Thus, the theory of creation in sequence is taught for the sake of the low grade of aspirants who have just begun to inquire, but who are still obsessed with the idea that the world is real. For the benefit of those aspirants who have progressed to the higher levels, the other view of simultaneous creation is presented. According to this view, the world arose like a dream on account of one's own thoughts induced by the defect of not knowing oneself as the non-dual spirit, Brahman. To those who have gained the plenary realization, there is no problem at all of having to explain creation. For there is no creation. And so this standpoint, if standpoint it may be called, is that of ajati, non-birth, non-creation. The term ajati also is but an approximation to the truth, and not the truth itself. As Gaudapada points out in the Mandukya Karika, ajati is meaningful only so long as jati carries meaning. And that is so in the empirical world alone. The absolute truth is that no word can designate or describe the self. The purpose of expression, ajati, is only to make us understand the self is not what appears to be born. Here again, one cannot be but struck by the complete identity of the teachings of Bhagavan Ramana and Acharya Gaudapada. We may refer to another piece of conversation, which shows that Ramana's experience is Advaita experience, and that the great sage arrived at this experience without any formal study of even Advaita text. The conversation is between the well-known French orientalist Oliver Lacombe and Bhagavan. Lacombe: is Maharshi's teaching the same as Shankara's? Bhagavan: Maharshi's teaching is only an expression of his own experience and realization. Others find that it tallies with Sri Shankara's. Lacombe: quite so. Can it be but put in other ways to express the same realization? Bhagavan: a realized person will use his own language. Silence is the best language. Not only has Bhagavan Ramana implicitly recognized the identity of his teaching with that of Shankara, but also he has explicitly stated that there is complete identity. Bhagavan has rendered into Tamil Shankara's hymn to Dakshinamurti, Atma Bodha Viveka Chudamani, and Dring Drishya Viveka. In the invocatory verses, which he has added to the first two of the above-mentioned works, Bhagavan declares, 1. That Shankara who came as Dakshinamurti to grant peace to the great ascetics, who revealed his true state of silence, and who has expounded the nature of the self in this hymn, abides in me. In the second verse, is the teacher Shankara, who grants the knowledge of the self, other than the self? Remaining in my heart as the self, he who utters the Tamil today, who is he other than that one himself? The original works of Bhagavan are veritable gems of Advaita literature. The two prose pieces, Self-Inquiry and Who Am I, which were composed at the beginning of the present century, set forth a technique of inquiry into the nature of the self, which is the direct means to realize according to Advaita. The Uladu Narpadu, along with its supplement, expounds the truth of non-duality, the self that is unconditioned pure existence, and also the disciplines that lead to the realization of the self. The same teaching is the theme of the Upadesharam, which ends by declaring that real austerity, tapas, is the realization of that which remains as the substrate when all trace of I is gone. The purport of even the devotional hymns to Arunachala sung by Bhagavan, as of the many stotras of Shankara, is a Dvaita experience. Obeisance to the succession of gurus, beginning with the Lord Shiva, having Shankara in the middle, and extending so far up to Ramana in our day.
I feel extremely edified.
Well, just remember.
Okay.
That Advaita covers everything.
Yeah.
You got the horoscope of Bhagavan in Hindu style. His horoscope in Western style appears on page 60 of this issue. Astrologers are invited to send their comments on it. I'm sure they got lots of letters. You know, Bhagavan selected, what, 10 verses? 11 verses from the Shivananda Lahari. It would be logical to say the path of knowledge and devotion are incompatible, since knowledge implies realization of the non-dual self, while devotion requires two, one to worship and one to be worshipped. However, logic does not always work. Human nature is not simple. And the same mind which, holding itself in abeyance, feels non-dual identity to be all, may also melt in devotion before him who is that all. A sign of this is that Shankara Acharya, the classical Advaitin and Vedantist, also composed devotional songs. Another is that Ramana Maharshi, the great Advaitin of modern times, wrote in his marital garland of letters to Sri Arunachala one of the greatest allegorical love poems of all times and all religions. He also selected 10 verses from Sri Shankara's hymn to Shiva, of which Professor T.M.P. Mahadeva's translation and commentary is reviewed in our July 1964 issue, and arranged them in an order which seemed to him effective. These 10 verses are given below, headed by their numbers in the original poem from Shivananda Lahari. 1. When the flow of the mind reaches the lotus feet of the Lord of Soul, footnote, a term for Shiva, and remains there always, just as the seeds of the ankola tree adhere to the tree, the needle to the magnet, the chaste wife to her husband, and the river to the ocean, that is called devotion. 2. Devotion, like the cloud in the sky of the great Lord, emits a shower of bliss. He whose mind is a lake to be filled by this reaps the full harvest of life. He and he alone. 3. Not the slightest happiness accrues from worshipping gods who are born and die. Of this there is no doubt. They who here adore the birthless, eternal Lord of Parvati are the fortunate ones. They it is who attain supreme happiness. 4. Will pot or lump of clay, will atom, whether of smoke, fire or mountain, whether of cloth or thread, footnote, these are conventional terms used in Hindu logic and argument. The meaning is, will academic philosophy help you in facing death? Will any of these serve as a bulwark against dread death? You only strain your throat unnecessarily by logic chopping. Hasten. You are wise to worship the lotus feet of Shambhu and attain the supreme happiness. 5. Consort of Parvati. What is impossible for him whose mind worships thy feet? At sight of him, Yama flees, fearing another kick in the chest. Footnote, this refers to the myth of Markandeya, a devotee who overcame Yama the god of death. The gods wave lamps consisting of the flaming gems set in their crowns, and the bride, liberation, clasps him an unyielding embrace. 6. Whether one is born a man or a god, a wild animal of the mountain or forest, a mosquito, a cow, or a worm, a bird or any other creature, what does it matter in what body? So long as the heart bathes endlessly in the supreme bliss of contemplation of thy lotus feet. 7. Tell me, what difference does it make whether one lives in a cave or a house, or in the open, in a forest, or on the top of a mountain, in water, or in fire? He, O Sambhu, is happy whose mind dwells at thy feet. That indeed is yoga, and he the supreme yogi. 8. O Lord of Uma, what a fool he is who enters a deep water tank or a fearful uninhabited forest or roams over a high mountain to gather flowers. [Footnote: Flowers are to be offered in worship. The water tank is included because it is there that lotus flowers would be gathered. He does not know how to live. He does not know how to live here in happiness, offering up to thee the single lotus of his heart. 9. What difference does it make, O Lord, whether one be a student, a householder, a renunciant, or a homeless wanderer? O Shambhu, Lord of souls, when one's heart lotus becomes thine, thou becomest his, and dost bear the burden of his life. 10. O crescent, crested Lord, through thy grace, the beginningless ignorance in the heart has been dispelled, and the joy of knowledge has taken its place. I meditate on and adore thy lotus feet, bearers of welfare and bestowers of liberation. Then Arthur Osborne writes aspects of Islam, Jnani, prophet and avatar. This is someone from Poland writes. Abbreviated from an article written in Polish by Jerry Czernia and published in the Catholic journal Kierunki Directions. The editor of that journal poses the question, why have we decided to publish this article in spite of our disagreement with the author and his statement of the equal value of different religious systems? And he answered, because we believe in acquainting the European mind with the most essential experiences of a basically spiritual culture. Unquote. That there can be a Catholic press in communist Poland and that it can be open to the wisdom of India, even though without understanding or approval are alike signs to be welcome.
We're deep into philosophy this morning.
Yeah. He quotes a lot about one in the article with your translation. A visit from Germany, adapted from the German. With light luggage in our two bedding rolls, Anand and I left Bangalore on February 8th. Next morning we arrived at Tiruvannamalai station after one change at Katpadi Junction. There we hired a jet car, a small horse cart that took us in about 20 minutes the 2.5 miles to the ashram, were expected. So someone was waiting for us. Passing through the arch entrance over which Sriraman Ashramam is written in Latin, letters, you know, English is Latin.
Yeah.
German. I had the strange feeling of having come home. I had difficulty in restraining my tears, so inexpressible was the feeling of well-being. The entire ashram, with its park-like compound, is pervaded by an atmosphere of peace and devotion. It is run by a collateral descendant of the Maharshi, who left the body in 1950. His spiritual heritage is preserved and spread by his Indian and foreign devotees. Visitors come from all over the world to this holy place where mankind's perennial questions, what is the purpose of life and how is it to be realized, are answered by the silent guidance and verbal instruction of an enlightened one of our times. Ramana Maharshi, the great Rishi of our modern age, taught that in all men, absolute being is already real. Quote, everyone is in fact the self and is eternal, but in spite of this, everyone mistakes the body for his self. It is to dissipate this mistake that enlightenment is necessary. Enlightenment illuminates both physical light and darkness. It is beyond both. It is neither one nor the other. Yet one calls it light because it penetrates both. The nature of light is eternal. It is consciousness, and consciousness is the self and can therefore be perceived by everybody. Nobody is ever separate from the self. Therefore, the self is in fact already realized. Only, and this is the greatest mystery, men are not aware of this, but continue to strive for realization. Actually, realization only consists of freeing oneself from the wrong idea that one is not already realized. It is not anything new that can be gained. Otherwise, it would not be eternal and would therefore not be worth seeking. Again, he said, when the wrong idea, I am this body, or I am not realized, drops away, the higher consciousness or self alone remains. Owing to their present state of relative consciousness, men call this realization. But the truth is that it exists eternally, here and now. Unquote. The mind springs from pure consciousness. It is made up of thoughts. When freed from ego, being is universal spirit, which is pure consciousness. This is what is meant in the Bible by the name, I am that I am. But when captured by the ego, it is too weak to withstand the affliction of thoughts. Happiness and unhappiness are only modes of thought. Arthur Osborne, author of several books and editor of The Mountain Path, has settled with his wife near the ashram and is spreading the Maharshi's teaching. Many other writers and visitors, both Indian and Western, are contributing to make the path to self-realization more widely known. In German, there is a work of Heinrich Zimmer, apart from various translations. And he died in New York, Heinrich Zimmer. Mm-hmm. Joseph Campbell's professor.
Right. He doesn't give him credit very often, though.
Did he ever?
I don't think so.
But he did the compilation of his...
His work, book. Yeah.
Yeah, The Myths and Symbols of Indian Art.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book.
The path taught by Ramana Maharshi is self-inquiry. The question, who am I? This is the path of knowledge, pure jnana marga. However, he always said that there are two paths. Ask yourself, who am I, or surrender completely. And surrender is bhakti marga. These two paths seem to be mutually exclusive, because if one is striving to realize his identity with the universal self through pure knowledge, it is not possible at the same time to worship or a god and guru. In fact, however, they are found not to be incompatible. The Maharishi expected his followers to continue their active life in the world and discourage those who wanted to renounce the world. Change of environment is no use, he said. It is the attitude of mind that must be changed. And if that is possible in solitude, in the forest, why not at home? So why change the environment? Independent of outer forms, the path of Maharishi taught combines and harmonizes the path of knowledge, jnana, bhakti, and unselfish action, karma.
Dennis, did you ever water ski?
Yeah, we used to do a lot in Niagara River.
I was thinking the way Bhagavan says you already are the self. You just have to stop striving or whatever. I remember when I was trying to learn to water ski. I was struggling so much to get my feet to do the thing until finally one time I didn't struggle at all and it just pulled me up by with it, you know, without trying. It was really strange.
How the Maharishi came to me, this Robert Hanlon, a devotee, I met him, he came from the New York ashram in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Back.
I first became, I think he was a writer or something. I first became aware of the name and grace of Bhagavan in December 1958. Since my father's death in 1956, I had been in a grave spiritual and psychological crisis. Playwriting efforts of many years stopped abruptly. I then worked as an advertising copywriter until the unconscious weight of the identity search made my job impossible. I started taking to a variety of drugs rather heavily and began an intensive reading of Freudian and mystical literature with the emphasis on Zen and yoga. As if miraculously, financial help from a new wealthy friend began at this time and made the total search for self economically feasible. Gradually, I started to meditate in the Zen tradition, not knowing that already the real presence of the Divine Lover was dictating my most stumbling efforts. I was using the koan. What was my original face before my father and mother were born? I would meditate for half an hour, read a page here of one book, two pages of another, until the need to meditate overpowered me once more. But I was conscious of no inward change that would relieve my cosmic anxiety. I was overwhelmed by doubts that I could ever break through the certitudes of immortality and the spirit. Then in December 1958, I went to Taos, New Mexico, to visit a friend who also engaged in the search for self. One day we went to see a rather advanced yogi and painter, Herman Rednick, who lived in a beautiful sagebrush desert along the Rio Grande Canyon. In his cabin, he had five or six framed pictures of Indian sages. One of these pictures was the most famous one of Bhagavan, reproduced on the cover of Arthur Osborne's biography, as above. Looking at it, I felt as if I had been waiting to see it for 10,000 years. The absolute serenity, sweetness, and love in his eyes overwhelmed me. For the first time I knew there was really something to be discovered, and that there was my guide to the Promised Land. Tears came unbidden to my eyes. I was also conscious of powerful vibrations in the cabin which filled me with exultation. I'm now aware that these vibrations were the initial transmission of the spirit and that Herman was the guru transmitting the grace of Bhagavan Sadguru, the one without a second. Returning to New York, I obtained Bhagavan's books and started to meditate according to his teaching. I also began praying to him using the mantra Om Ramana, as given by Mudaliar day by day with Bhagavan. I stopped taking drugs completely. thanks to the ever-pouring grace of the Divine Savior. Several times during the succeeding months, the idea came to me to lie down on my bed and see if I could return to the womb in a psychic sense, to go back to the way you came in, as Bhagavan told one devotee. These attempts had no results until the 22nd of December 1959. This time at noon, I was immediately conscious that something extraordinary had happened, that in some inexplicable way I had returned to the womb, although I was still completely conscious of my surroundings and adult identity. Then the question came, where did I come from before I was in the womb? No sooner was this question out than a white light opened above and between the eyes. In it I saw what seemed to be black objects moving about. The word spermatozoa flashed through my mind, and with no conscious volition on my part, I was not familiar with St. Augustine's statement of the logos, spermaticos, until several years later. This word, in its turn, triggered a complete rigidity of the body, so that I was aware of being completely in the grip of a higher power. A golden light appeared at the loins, and three spiraling lines of light came up the body. The great golden light stopped momentarily at the navel and then rose to the forehead, where it took on the shape of a cone. My whole consciousness went through the horn, and I was immersed in the ocean of bliss. Immediately I said, of course I remember, this is my original face. After a very short time, the consciousness came back into the body, which was now all white. The golden horn lingered for a few seconds, then came down again into the navel, and so back to the loins. I now understood the significance of the myth of the unicorn. Still, such was the obstinacy of the ever-clinging ego, despite this overpowering blissful rebirth of the spirit, which transformed faith into knowledge. I had no certitude that the spirit which had led me to this beatitude of light was truly Bhagavan. Thus was I questioning several nights later, how do I know it is Bhagavan who has rescued me from my ignorance, not simply any familiar spirit? When once again my body was gripped by a superior force, slowly my head was turned in the chair to the left, where the picture of Bhagavan, which had first enthralled me in New Mexico, was hanging. My gaze was held rigidly on the picture for some time, while the thought came to my mind from an inner voice, now do you see? Now at last do you see? Now at last I saw. The power of the holy name of Bhagavan, Sri Ramana, the beatitude and salvation in his holy gaze, have been my surety and bliss ever since that day. To me, now, all life is a countless succession of Bhagavan's favors. Many extraordinary things have happened daily. Pain and suffering have not disappeared from my life, but I accept them now as the will of Bhagavan, to whom I have surrendered as best I can. I am conscious at all times of the real presence of my Savior. May I one day be worthy of the overpowering love which He has showered upon me.
What is the essence of Advaita? What would you say, what? Like in a nutshell, Advaita?
What non-dualism. Is it? Non-dualism.
Non-dualism. Just that.
I remember this guy.
Henry.
Bhagavan, he must have met Bhagavan a few times because he was familiar when he came in the ashram. You know?
Yeah.
This one.
What was he like?
He was tall and, you know, intellectual type guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened to him. I only saw him once when he came to the ashram, but talked with Bhagavan for a while. But Bhagavan seemed to have known him, so he must have come some other time. You know.
Bhagavan seemed to know him.
Yeah.
But I'm a bit
very confused with if he's still seeing light. Is that
he's not still seeing light? I don't think. You know, he had that experience.
Okay. Yeah.